Okay.
Now, and our speaker is with us too, and everything appears to be working. Let me see. I was going to ask David if he had any upcoming
Yeah, yeah, there are a few. They're given in the newsletter, and we're actually going to try to observe a few of them, weather permitting, because we're going to be in Greenbelt from the first to the second week of January. More interesting was the Kuiper Belt occultation that we had that was predicted by Lucky Star Project to pass over Washington, D.C., and it turned out it did. And so there were four observers in Maryland and a couple in Northern Virginia who got nice recordings of it. Then combined with observers from upstate New York, even in a bunch in Europe, we got a nice about 15 chords across the object. It's not an unusual shape. It's can be fit by a pretty good fit with an ellipse. So that's in the Stardust. You can see the details of that. And that night was interesting for us. You know, we were in North Carolina at the time, and so we were outside of the path. But we got to see the Crew 3 launch of the four astronauts going up to the space station. There was a fellow that was with us who pointed out, "What's that fuzzy comet moving across the sky?" We looked up and, well, that was really strange. We hadn't seen a plane like that or anything, but it had a parabolic plume coming out the back with a little dot moving across. And we learned later what it was.
Thank you for that report, Dave. I see your wife in the background. Are there any more reports for the good of the order before I mute myself and turn it over to our excellent vice president who will introduce our speaker? Hearing nothing, I'm muting myself.
Well, it's a great pleasure to introduce Dr. Brian J. Williams of the Goddard Space Flight Center, our speaker this evening. He obtained his bachelor's in physics at Florida State University in Tallahassee and a PhD in physics from North Carolina State University. And his PhD research and much of his research since has focused on observations of and modeling of supernova remnants. And supernova remnants can tell us about dust grains in the interstellar medium. He's worked extensively in IR. Well, let me say a little bit more about his career. He had a postdoc for 5 years at Goddard after his PhD, then went to the Space Science Telescope in Baltimore, Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore for 2 years. That's the group that provides mission support for both the Hubble, and it will be providing it for the James Webb Space Telescope too. Then he came back to Goddard, where in addition to his previous line of research, he's project scientist for the future X-ray imaging and spectroscopy mission. He's also acting chief scientist for the Physics of the Cosmos Program Office at NASA, which is very important to everyone who wants funding. In 2020, he was the recipient of the NASA Early Career Achievement Medal. And he's worked extensively in IR visible X-ray and gamma ray astronomy. You've heard of, first of all, his research pretty much all along has focused on remnants of supernovae and on particular what happens to the dust within them. You've heard of supernovae and you probably know that the famous Crab Nebula is the remnant of a supernova that was actually observed in 1054. Studying these remnants in detail provides an enormous amount of information about how things work on astronomical scales, including the dispersal and destruction of dust within a galaxy. The reason that's important is that the dust plays a huge role in the formation of giant molecular clouds and even contributes some gas to those clouds. And collapses of parts of giant molecular clouds are how stars form nowadays and how their attendant planetary systems form. That dust produces much of the ingredients that eventually became us. Dr. Williams has even studied supernova remnants in the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is one of the two small irregular satellite galaxies of our Milky Way that are gradually being torn apart by the gravity of the Milky Way and on their way to being absorbed by the Milky Way. He's also worked on identifying the progenitors of supernovae. It's a very challenging thing to do, but if you can do it, that could enable us to look at the right spot in the sky in time to really measure the early stages of supernova, of a supernova. So, Dr. Williams.
Okay, thank you, John, for that extremely detailed introduction. I did have one quick question logistically for you. How do you all typically like to handle questions? Do you just sort of pop in throughout the talk? Do we save them for the end? I'm happy to do whatever, just let me know.
Your choice.
I really don't have a preference. If people want to pop in and interrupt me, that's fine. If you prefer to save them to the end, that's fine. I've written what I think is somewhere around a 45 minute to an hour talk. So I hope we can.
That should be perfect. I can watch for any hands raised and interrupt if there is a question, but it really is up to you.
Okay. Like I said, I'm fine with either.
Okay.
We are a patient group.
Let me start to share my slides. And if you could just confirm that you can see those. Okay, great. Well, again, thank you. Let me just see if I can move the participant window out of the way here. There we go. Now I can see. So I'm actually going to, I'm going to give sort of two talks tonight. I'll try to segue between the two so that it makes sense. But the first one will sort of be on some of the scientific research that I've done throughout my career. And then the second half will be on what I actually get paid to do, which is develop future missions for NASA. And so the title of my talk, and actually, John, I didn't ask you to lead me in like that, but you actually did a great job mentioning the Crab Nebula, which is the remnant of the supernova of 1054. Because actually the first half of my talk, I'm going to be talking about historical supernovae, and it'll be sort of an introduction, weaving in some history and science all together. And then the second half, I'll talk about the future of X-ray astronomy, which is what I do these days. So I'm going to start with a very simple and pretty non-controversial statement, and that is that the night sky is full of stars. And for the most part, the night sky doesn't change a whole lot. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing whether you're an ancient culture trying to use the stars for guidance across the sea, or whether you're a backyard astronomer trying to go to your favorite target at night. It's pretty good that we actually don't have a new set of stars every night, and the universe is relatively static in that sense. But of course, relatively static and completely static are not the same thing, and I'm sure many of you in the audience will remember and probably recognize exactly this picture, as well as maybe the Time magazine cover. This is a before and after picture of February of 1987 in the Large Magellanic Cloud. All of a sudden, a star exploded. And this was the first, you know, naked eye observable supernova in hundreds of years, which I'll talk about that in a little while. And so it was, you know, we certainly knew about exploding stars before, but this sort of revolutionized the field and really, pun intended, exploded into a new field. So here's what's important about a supernova for this talk. I'm certainly not going to get into all of the details, but they are relatively rare. They are, as I said, the explosions of an entire star. They are monumentally powerful. Roughly once per century per galaxy, give or take, a star will explode. They are extraordinarily bright. I mean, we can see them billions of light years away. They can actually rival their entire galaxy in brightness over the course of weeks. But they actually, you know, after the initial pop, they don't just go away. They actually turn into what we call a supernova remnant, which is essentially just the expanding explosion of the star that it's almost like watching a firework that takes, you know, tens of thousands of years to dissipate instead of, you know, a few seconds. The image that you see down there at the bottom right, and I'll show certainly a lot more of these, is what an exploded star looks like a few hundred or a few thousand years after it's exploded. So it is very difficult to overstate the amount of energy that is released when an entire star explodes. I mean, supernovae, they are, despite being relatively rare, they are a major component of the entire energy feedback process for galaxies. Some of you may have seen this cartoon before if you're familiar at all with the webcomic XKCD. The guy who writes that used to write a weekly column called What If, where he would take some fun science question, sort of delve into it a little bit. And I borrowed this from his website. Which of the following would be brighter in terms of the amount of energy that you would feel? A supernova seen as far away from the sun as from the Earth, 100 million miles or so, or the detonation of a nuclear bomb pressed against your face? The answer is number one, and it's not even particularly close. I mean, these are extraordinarily powerful events. Something the mass of the sun, which is a million times the mass of the Earth, exploding at several percent the speed of light is just, you know, is an incredible amount of energy. Why are supernovae important? Well, I could give an entire talk on the answers to that question, but for my money, the single most important reason that supernovae are important is that they are responsible for seeding the cosmos with elements. I'm sure most of you are aware that stars spend their lives fusing elements. They all start of mostly hydrogen, and then they fuse hydrogen into helium. And then if they're a little bit more massive, they can fuse helium into carbon and nitrogen and oxygen. And if they get a little bit more massive still, they can just sort of keep going up the periodic table. But the thing is, all of those elements stay within the star. The fusion is all going on in the core. So if there were no exploding stars, the universe would be a pretty boring place, because all you would have would just be stars with these, you know, highly enriched cores, but nothing would ever get out of that. And the universe would have no life, no planets, no anything like that. So the fact that we are here, and of course, I'm sure you've all seen the famous quote from Carl Sagan on the right, is that we are made of star stuff. So we are literally made of the stuff that is only here now because some previous star not only cooked it up, but had to explode in order to spread it throughout the cosmos. As I mentioned, supernovae are extraordinarily bright. We can see them in distant supernovae. There's a little image gallery here of before and after. The before is on the top. The after is on the bottom for some distant galaxies. These pictures are actually from Hubble. And the fact that that's what the galaxies look like, even with Hubble, tells you how far away they are. I mean, these are the ones in this image gallery here, billions of light years away. And you can sort of see that at peak brightness, those point sources that are supernovae rival their entire host galaxy of hundreds of billions of stars in brightness. So the ones in distant galaxies aren't too hard to detect. We've actually gotten very good at it these days. We detect thousands of supernovae per year using robotic surveys, you know, ground-based telescopes for the most part are what does most of that work. But they're still very far away. Here is a list of nearby supernovae in modern times, and I'll qualify both of those words. Nearby, I mean either in the Milky Way galaxy or in one of our satellite galaxies like the Magellanic Clouds. Modern, I mean in the past couple of hundred years, let's say from the invention of the telescope on. The first one, as I've mentioned, is 87A. This is the Hubble image of 87A. Now you can sort of see this brilliant ring. This, I assume you can see my mouse. This ring right here is now the expanding blast wave of the supernova. And that's it. That's the end of the list. That is the entire list of nearby supernovae in modern times. However, when we look around for supernova remnants, which, as I said, last for thousands or tens of thousands of years in the Milky Way, we have several hundred of these things that we can study. And so since we haven't been able to get too close to a supernova for a while to study it up close, if we want to learn about these things, we really have to look at the remnants of these things now and try to figure out. It's almost like being a detective going to the scene of the crime afterwards and trying to reproduce what happened. So just a little quick cartoon primer here on what exactly a supernova remnant is. As I said, it's the expanding blast wave of the star. The initial velocity is usually of order 10 to 20,000 kilometers per second. If you recall, the speed of light is 300,000 kilometers per second. So we're talking sizable fractions, you know, more than 5% the speed of light for an expansion velocity at the beginning. They eventually slow down as they start to run into more and more material in the interstellar medium. But basically, you know, this is sort of a textbook example of one. This is one in the Large Magellanic Cloud. You sort of have this forward blast wave out here that's expanding rapidly. It's heating up the gas to X-ray emitting temperatures. This is an X-ray image. It's from Chandra. The internal stuff here, all this blue stuff, has been color-coded because that is the ejected material that was once part of the star. So this is extremely rich in these heavy elements like oxygen and silicon and iron and all the useful stuff that makes cool things in the universe. This is just an image gallery of a couple of supernova remnants. These are all Chandra X-ray images, sometimes overlaid on an optical background to show all the stars. One of the things I love, you know, I love my job for a lot of reasons, but I think these are absolutely some of the most beautiful objects in the universe. I mean, every one is different, and that's due to a lot of factors. That might be due to how the supernova exploded, might be due to the material that it's running into. That's part of what we're researching when we're doing this stuff, is finding out, you know, what is the diversity of these things and why are they so diverse? But what I wanted to do tonight is go back through some of the ancient supernovae in you know, modern is sort of a joke here. It's not really the modern age of astronomy because it's going to be over the past few thousand years. But my modern here, what I mean is that, do we actually have a written record of the supernova going off? And if so, what do we see when we look there today? I'm going to start from the beginning, from what we believe is the oldest documented example of a supernova. This goes back over 1,800 years. In the year 185, there is an existing record from Chinese astronomers of the day who noted what they call in translation as a guest star in the sky. They recorded an approximate position sort of near the modern, what we now know as Alpha Centauri. It lasted for at least 8 months before fading away. It's too far south to be observed from Europe. It's a declination of like minus 68, which you actually can get from the southern parts of China. You can get several degrees above the horizon. And if you work out the air masses between along your line of sight, it actually is possible that a supernova of sort of standard brightness could have been seen with the naked eye. As I said, this is, we believe, the first example of a historical supernova. And when we look at it today, this is what we see. It has a catalog number of RCW 86. That was a catalog from the 60s. But this is a combined X-ray and infrared image of the supernova remnant. You can see the roughly circular shape here. This is where the outer blast wave has reached at this point. You don't see a lot of ejecta in the middle, but this blue stuff here and this blue stuff up here is all iron-rich ejecta that we are seeing now. This thing in 1,800 years has grown to a diameter of roughly 100 light years, which is extremely important. I mean, if you think about, you know, the distance from here to Alpha Centauri is about 4 light years. So if you were to sort of do a ballpark calculation, take a sphere of 100 light years in diameter and think about how many stars would be in that sphere, it's thousands. And so that's what I mean when I say that, you know, one supernova can seed thousands of potential star systems and planet forming systems with the elements necessary to evolve into life. So that's still, to me, as I said earlier, sort of the coolest thing about doing this. It's a dynamic field of astronomy. I'll show you later what I mean by dynamic, but it's also, it has a very intimate connection to life itself, to our very existence. Moving on, the one I just mentioned in RCW 86, I wouldn't say it's a rock solid connection with the guest star of 185 AD. I mean, I would say it's 90% certain. I think somebody else might say it's 50%. The first supernova that we are essentially 100% rock solid in identifying it was a supernova in 1006 AD. Part of the reason we're very confident on this is we actually have ancient texts from a lot of different parts of the world. We have them from China, from Japan, Korea. We even have some from Europe. it's interesting to get records from Europe during this time, because Europe was kind of still in the dark ages. They hadn't really come out of that yet. So records from this time in Europe are not great. But there was a monastery in Switzerland that has kept records since that time. And they have a record, and, you know, at the time of year, which matches exactly with everyone else. And they have, you know, they basically said what constellation it was in. There is a possible, this petroglyph from Native America in Arizona. I'm not at all an expert in Native American rock art, but people who are say that they believe this dates to that approximate time period. And so this is pretty speculative, of course, but some say that perhaps this petroglyph might show the appearance of this new star in the sky. And when we look there today, we see this, which we now know as the remnant of SN 1006. This was very bright. It's fairly nearby. It's only a few thousand light years away. It reached a peak magnitude of something like minus 7.5. There are multiple reports of visibility during the daytime. It stayed visible for something like 2 years. And when we look at today, that is the remnant. That thing, I don't know, I haven't done the calculation to what the actual physical size is, but an angular size, that's about the size of the full moon. It's about 30 arc minutes in diameter. And again, this is an X-ray image, because supernova remnants tend to be very bright emitters in X-rays. And the reason for that is when you run a shockwave at thousands of kilometers per second through the interstellar medium, you tend to heat up that gas a lot. So all the gas that's been encountered by this blast wave has now been heated to millions, if not tens of millions of degrees. That is extraordinarily hot, and that emits a lot of X-rays. You actually don't get a ton of optical emission from these. If I showed you the Hubble image of SN 1006, which you could go and find online, all you actually see is this little filament up here at the top. You don't see anything else from the rest of this. It's literally just too hot to emit an optical. So it has to cool down a lot. The one that was mentioned in the introduction was the supernova of 1054 AD. This was a very bright new star, first seen on what we would now call the 4th of July in 1054. There are very good records from Chinese astronomers that have been kept. I certainly don't read Chinese, but this is a picture of the records, and people tell us that this is a very clear both time, date, and, you know, position of where this new star was. There are some possible records from everywhere. Again, I was able to find, there's a possible Native American cave drawing of this that dates to around that time period. But as John mentioned in the introduction, this is what we now know as the Crab Nebula. This is sort of an unusual supernova remnant. What we're actually seeing here is just what we call a pulsar wind nebula, where we have a pulsar at the center. A pulsar is a neutron star that has roughly the mass of the sun, which is about a million times the mass of the entire Earth, but it's extraordinarily dense. It would easily fit within the Capital Beltway, usually, you know, 10 kilometers, 20 kilometers or so in diameter. And the thing is spinning so rapidly that it's pulsing 30 times a second, and it's just giving off massive amounts of energy. And in fact, you can see the Hubble image there on the left and the Chandra image on the right. And some of you may have seen this before, but you can actually make a video. Now, this is not in real time, of course. These are the frames in this are spaced over something like a year. But if you come back every couple of months or so and observe it, you can make a multi-frame image. And that's Chandra on the left, and I believe Hubble on the right. And I'll let that loop one more time so you can see it. You can find this online if you just Google Crab Nebula movie or something like that. So you can see the pulsar is just giving off so much energy into the surrounding matter that it's sort of just driving waves out into it. The next one that I wanted to get to was the famous Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe. He observed a new star in November 1572. Publication on it, which translates to "Concerning the Star, New and Never Before Seen in the Life or Memory of Anyone," which is a great paper. I've never written a paper title that's that cool. He measured the parallax of this. This was before, you know, this was really before physics was really a thing. So he, of course, didn't really know what was happening, but he knew, you know, how to do parallax. He showed that because of the parallax, it had to be beyond the moon and the planets. And that was interesting because at the time, the only things that moved or changed positions in the sky were things that we knew were nearby. So we knew the planets move. We would see comets occasionally. Obviously, the moon traces a path across the sky, as does the sun. But this was the first time that anyone ever had ever, you know, definitively shown that something beyond our local sphere was changing. This was a monumental finding at the time. The Catholic Church did not like this. They liked the heavens to be immutable. So this was really a boat rocking thing that that happened in the 16th century. So much so that I was able to find a quote online that I've used many times in talks before. Queen Elizabeth supposedly called in the royal astrologer to have his advice about the new star which appeared in Cassiopeia, to which he gave his judgment very learnedly. And this is a direct quote from a British historian that I found online. I would love to have been in that court in 1572 to know what an astrologer would have told the queen. I assume he probably just made something up on the spot that meant, you know, oh, you will reign for, you know, many years, great queen. I assume he was able to keep his head. There is one historian of astronomy who has made a somewhat convincing case. I'm not entirely convinced, but I leave that to you to go find it. He makes a case that this might be the star that's referenced in the opening scene of Hamlet. So what do we see there today? We see this. This is what we now just call Tycho's supernova remnant. This is a combined X-ray image with some infrared emission there as well. This is a really cool table. This is actually from a paper in 1945 by Walter Bade, who went back to the writings of Tycho, and you can sort of see here, he has the date in 1572 through 1574, and he has Tycho's descriptions as he wrote them. So almost as bright as Venus, about as bright as Jupiter. And then he kind of goes down and says equal to brightnesses of such and such stars. So as the months and years went on. And Bade reconstructed, converted those into what we now know as the magnitude system, and was able to reconstruct what we now call a light curve, which is just the brightness as a function of time. And he correctly identified the type of supernova that this was. He identified it as a type one. At the time, there were only type one and type two. Astrophysics was not yet at a point where he knew what type one and type two were, but they just classified them based on whether or not they had hydrogen lines in the spectrum or the light curve, the shape of the light curve being different. So we now, the supernova classification scheme is now massively complicated. I won't get into it in this talk. But Bade was able to correctly identify the type of supernova that this was using Tycho's original writings. The cool thing about some of these objects like Tycho, since we're now getting into, you know, an object exploded in 1572 and it now looks like that, and that's something like 8 arc minutes across. So in 400 years, it's expanded by 8 arc minutes. And we now have really high resolution telescopes up there, and they've been up there for a little while. So Chandra was launched in 1999, and it has observed Tycho multiple times. The VLA has been around since the 80s. It is also a bright radio source. And in fact, we can actually watch this thing evolve. So this is a movie. This is a movie in several frames. It just is gonna loop multiple times here. And you can actually see that the Chandra images from 2000, 2003, 2007, 2009, 2015 were just put together, constructed onto a common coordinate system. And we could actually watch this thing expand in real time. Real time, of course, being relative to an astronomer's career. But with this, we can do things like directly measure the expansion velocities now. We can even measure the expansion velocities of all this fluffy sort of cotton candy looking stuff in the center, which is the ejected material of the star. And that's interesting because the expansion velocity of the ejected material it relates back to both the energy of the star. It relates to the density structure of the star before it exploded. So we are really getting into a new era of astronomy now, just in the past decade or so, where we have long enough baseline observations that we can start to do effectively time-resolved astronomy by just going back every couple of years and watching this thing again. I mentioned it was in radio as well. This is the same thing in radio. This is a VLA movie. I don't have the dates on this one, but I think it starts in 1984 and the most recent one was 2014. So you can just, you can do exactly the same thing in radio as you did in X-rays. Moving on, Johannes Kepler, Tycho's protege, observed a new star in 1604. Now I've given a lot of talks on Kepler in my career. I've given them at, you know, professional astronomy conferences to groups like this. I've always used this picture of Kepler. I just found out something interesting though, a couple of months ago. Some of you may have seen this. There was an article on Physics Today that came out. I don't know how easy it is to see that date, but it's September 1st of 2021. So just about 3 months ago, some historians, some art historians started looking into this. And they no longer believe that is a picture of Kepler. Certainly, at least not one that was painted when he was alive. They now believe this picture dates to the 19th century instead of the, you know, 1600s. I won't summarize this article here, but you can go read it on your own. If you just Google, I tested this out right before. And if you Google Kepler Physics Today, don't put them in quotes, just put those three words into Google. It was the first result that popped up, and it was not behind a paywall for me, so you should be able to read it. It's an interesting article. They did, however, give me an alternative picture in that article. They say that this picture is believed to be a portrait painted of Kepler while he was alive. So I will forever be updating my slide decks with this picture instead of the old one. Moving on to Kepler's new star, he, of course, was the most prominent astronomer in the world after his mentor Tycho had died. If you want to be slightly entertained, go to Wikipedia and look up Tycho Brahe's article and look up how he died. Don't do it now, do it after my talk, but it's a pretty interesting way to go out. This is Kepler's publication, De Stella Nova in Pede Serpentari, which translates to On the New Star in the Foot of Ophiuchus. This is his sketch. You can actually see this N right here. N stands for Nova, which of course is just Latin for new. So there was his new star. He charted it with respect to other stars, meaning that we can very easily now go and identify exactly where in the sky that was. And when we look now, this is what it looks like 417 years later. I have an X-ray image on the left and an infrared image on the right. And if you put them together to make a nice, pretty image, this is what you get. This, by the way, is the last confirmed historical supernova in the Milky Way. Coincidentally, it was also 2 years before the telescope was invented in 1606. So we have literally not had a galactic supernova that we have seen since the telescope has been invented. So we're a little overdue, we think. There's possibly one more. Cassiopeia A is a very famous remnant. I'm sure some of you have seen this picture before. There is maybe a dubious record linked to an observation by the English astronomer Flamsteed in 1680. We say it's dubious not because the record itself is dubious, but there's a lot of magnitudes of extinction in the direction of Cass A. And it's just not entirely clear that it even would have been visible from Earth at that time. So maybe Flamsteed saw something else, or maybe he really did see it. I don't know. That concludes the first portion of my talk. I want to pause here and ask if there are any questions on any of the stuff that I've done so far, because I'm going to sort of shift gears and talk about future X-ray astronomy missions. So let me just pause here and ask if there are any questions thus far.
I've got a couple. You showed an image with what was it? It was let me go back. It caught reverse shock.
Yep.
That was one thing. If you could explain that a bit, and have you heard about the possible origin of writing in Mesopotamia about 4000 BC from a nova or a supernova that might have been seen, and it's questionable.
So I'll answer the second part first. I'm not familiar with that. If you want to drop a link in the chat or something, I can certainly check that out afterwards. That would be interesting. I'm not familiar with that though, no. To answer the first part of your question, I'm glad you brought that up. I should have explained that a little better. Let me actually go back. It's not that many slides. I know exactly the slide you're talking about. This one. So yeah, what happens when a supernova explodes, or when anything explodes, you will have an initial blast wave that just starts expanding out. And in space, it's spherical. On Earth, you know, you've seen a mushroom cloud on Earth. That's because gravity is, you know, pulling down. In space, it's, you know, essentially perfectly spherical. That blast wave starts racing out. Now, eventually, the blast wave is going to start interacting with, you know, the material that's out there, because space is almost a vacuum, but it's not a perfect vacuum. There are, you know, there is stuff in the interstellar medium. There's particles of gas and dust. And eventually, we call it like the snowplow phase. You start driving a snowplow through snow, and the snow weighs nothing. You just go as fast as you want through it. But eventually, you build up enough snow, and even the snowplow starts to slow down. Well, imagine you had an entire line of one snowplow, one behind the other, but only the one up front is encountering the snow. As it starts to slow down, the snow plows behind it are just going to start piling into it. You can actually observe this on the interstate. If one car slows down, everybody behind them has to slow down as well. And this actually generates a reverse shock wave that starts propagating backwards. And it really does go backwards. You can probably find videos online or something that sort of show a hydrodynamic simulation of this. And it's important that reverse shock goes backwards, because that is actually what heats up the ejected material inside the middle of the supernova remnant. So basically what you have here is this material out here was the stuff that's heated up by the forward shock wave that's moving outward. This material in here has been heated up by a reverse shock wave that has propagated back inwards. So hopefully that sort of answers your question on the reverse shock.
Your Alpha Centauri supernova, that tells us where it is in the sky, but do we know anything about how far away it was?
This one, you mean?
Yes, I believe.
Yeah. So, you know, distance in astronomy is always tricky. We do have some indication of this one. We think this one is around 2.5 kiloparsecs, which if you prefer light years, I guess that's about 8,000 light years or so. when historians have looked into this, and you take that distance and the brightness of a typical supernova, and we think now we know what type of supernova this was, take the, you know, extinction in that direction along the line of sight, that should have easily been visible on Earth from about that far away. So distances with supernova remnants are a little bit tricky, but we can usually get them, you know, to within a reasonable fraction. You know, I can tell you it's not 10 kiloparsecs away, and I can tell you it's not 1,000 kiloparsecs away, but it's probably about 2,500 parsecs.
Thank you, Brian. That's very helpful.
Any others?
Yes. I was wondering, is there some signature we could see on Earth for these events that happened before we have written records? I'm thinking in terms of the solar storms of 992 AD, I think, that left a signature in tree rings.
Yeah.
What would we be looking for if we're looking for a supernova event?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are things like that. People have looked into that before. There is some evidence that some previous supernovae, and probably much longer ago, probably, you know, millions of years ago, very close by to Earth, may have left signatures in the isotope levels of rock for, you know, as you go down in the rocks, you're sort of doing a geological record, and you can watch the isotope fraction change. And we're not sure why it changed, because we weren't around. But one possibility is that very local nearby supernovae over the past millions or even billions of years could have had an impact on the isotopic fractions in rocks. And even in the ocean floor, people have found evidence as they drill down into the core. So, yeah.
Okay, this is David Dunham. I just wanted to point out the supernova of 185 If you do a calculation of with the precession, that in 185, the position Alpha Centauri and that supernova was quite a bit farther north in the sky. It was about declination minus 54 or so instead of minus 68. So it should have been visible from the southern, all of the southern half of China, and should have been visible from Egypt, but it would have been right on the horizon for people in southern Greece. So the Europeans would have mostly missed it, the ones who were knowledgeable at that time. But there might be some Arabic records or something from Egypt that you know, might show that if someone might find.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Thanks for pointing that out. There are definitely people, I mean, I wouldn't say the field of historians who do astronomy is a huge field, but there are definitely people who look into things like this. And as far as I know, the only you know, pretty solid record that they've found is the one from China. But, you know, history is not all in the past. And we find new records, stuff all the time, and archaeological things. So, yeah, I mean, I'll certainly be very interested if anyone, even in the future, were to go back and find records in some of these other cultures. So, great point. Okay, was there any others?
Just along that line there, any inklings of anything that the Polynesians might have seen that they passed on?
What I've included in this talk is everything that I know as far as the records. There are books on stuff like this. There's a book that's written by a guy named Dave Green, who's an astronomer at Cambridge. There's a co-author on the book. I think it's Stevenson. I think it's Stevenson and Green, or Green and Stevenson. They actually wrote a book on historical supernovae. If you're interested, I'm sure you can get a copy of that on Amazon or something. I don't have a copy personally, but I've seen it and read through it. It's a fascinating read. But I personally, what I've given you here is pretty much the extent of my expertise on the actual historical records.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, shall I go on? Well, as I said, I'm going to transition here from telling you about the history of astronomy to I'm going to now tell you about the future of astronomy. As John mentioned on the chat, my day job is I'm the project scientist at NASA for a new mission that I'm going to tell you about. It's not Chandra. Chandra is a mission that's been up for about 21 years now. But it is an X-ray observatory, and as you might have noticed, almost all the images I showed you were X-ray. As John mentioned in the intro, my PhD work was mostly in infrared astronomy. I've since transitioned almost entirely to the X-rays, but I, along with everyone else, am certainly eagerly anticipating the launch of James Webb in a few weeks, and I'll try to get back to my roots in infrared astronomy. But for now, I do X-rays, and this is... NASA's flagship X-ray mission for the past few decades has been Chandra. Let me give you a quick primer on how X-ray astronomy hardware works for those who may not be familiar with it. We do not work the same way that optical mirrors work. With an optical mirror, and this is the case for the telescopes that I'm sure you all have and that I have, all the way up to, you know, Hubble or Keck or anything like that. If you're an optical telescope, pretty much everyone now is a reflecting telescope. So you send a photon in, it bounces off the mirror, and you focus it. X-rays have a bad habit of penetrating through mirrors, so we can't really reflect them. It is possible to do normal incidence X-ray reflection, but that's a different talk. Instead, what we do is we use something called grazing incidence. So it's exactly like skipping a rock across a pond. If you come in shallow enough, you can just graze off, and you'll just sort of bounce back up. So instead of having mirrors that you know, reflect back, we just sort of shallow angle reflect them down, and we have a primary and a secondary because the fundamental laws of optics still apply. This is your primary and your secondary behind that, and you can focus X-rays this way down to a focal point where you can put your detector. The way you make an X-ray telescope bigger is you either make you know, more mirrors going out here, or you make a lot more mirrors in here with just a small gap in between every one of them. X-ray astronomy is a little different beast than optical astronomy because they're not nearly as numerous. In optical astronomy, you point at a star or a nebula or something. You're not really worried about how many photons you're getting because you're usually getting a lot. X-rays, you might get one photon per second, even from a relatively bright source. So we typically have to integrate on these things for a long time. X-ray observations can be measured. We measure them in kiloseconds, which is 1,000 seconds. And a typical X-ray observation might be 100 kiloseconds, which is of order a day. So we'll spend an entire day pointing at a target, accumulating photons from that and reconstructing an image from that. This has both pros and cons. The cons are kind of obvious that it just takes a long time to make a nice X-ray image. But the pro is that since every photon is coming in and everyone counts, we can actually get spectral information. We can get information on the energy of that photon as it comes in. And so when we point Chandra at an image like this, this is Kepler's supernova, the one from 1604, we can also get a spectrum of that object. Now the current generation X-ray telescopes use CCDs, which is charged coupled devices. It's fundamentally the same type of cameras that digital cameras here use. Your cell phone has some version of a CCD in it. And I won't get into the details of how those work, but essentially we can get energetic information on every photon that comes in and we can reconstruct a spectrum of this. So this is what an X-ray spectrum looks like. This is real data from Chandra of Kepler supernova. You can see here in X-rays, we work in energy space. We don't work in wavelength space typically, but this is what a spectrum of 10 million or so degree gas looks like. You have a strong thermal continuum here from the hot gas. You have some lines from various elements. So you've got oxygen right here. You've got iron up in here. This is magnesium, silicon, sulfur. It actually goes on. I cut it off at a few keV here just so I could zoom in on this. But there are lines of argon, calcium. There's a very prominent line of iron at 6.5 keV. But if you've seen, I don't know how many of you actually ever do spectroscopy, but I'm sure you've seen spectra shown in previous talks before. This doesn't really look like a spectrum because typically when you see a spectral line, you anticipate it to be sort of a very sharp peak, not a rolling curve like this. Well, this is just a function of the fact that we don't have very good resolution in the spectral domain with CCDs and with the older generation of X-ray telescopes. They're not designed for that. But it is possible to do much better spectroscopy. And that is what we are doing now with a mission called CRISM. If you take nothing else away from my talk, that is how we pronounce this word, X-R-I-S-M, CRISM. That stands for X-ray Imaging and Spectroscopy Mission. And the name of the game for CRISM is to do high resolution X-ray spectroscopy. So we will go from a spectrum that looks like that to a spectrum that looks like that. That is the exact same underlying physics spectrum. I'll do it again just for dramatic effect. This is current data. That's what Chandra sees when it gets a spectrum of Kepler. With CRISM, we will get something that looks like this, just orders of magnitude improvement in the spectral quality. And we're actually able to do real spectroscopy. So what is CRISM? Well, it is a collaborative mission between JAXA and NASA. ESA is a small participant in that. JAXA is, of course, the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency. It is primarily a JAXA mission, but NASA has major hardware contributions and is a major science partner on this. We have two instruments. One is called RESOLVE. RESOLVE is really our workhorse instrument. That's what we anticipate most of the science results will come out of. It is a soft X-ray spectrometer providing non-dispersive high-resolution X-ray spectroscopy. We do have imaging capabilities, but we are not a high-resolution imaging telescope. Our imaging resolution will be 1 to 1.5 arc minutes or so. but the other instrument on board is called EXTEND. It is a very large field of view. I'll show you later how large it is, about 40 arc minutes on a side. That's really big for the X-ray world, I promise. Soft X-ray imaging instrument. We are scheduled to launch from Japan. The target is still in Japanese fiscal year 2022. Their fiscal year is offset by ours from 6 months. So JFY 2022 is from April of 22 to March of 23. The mission is to recover the science lost after the demise of a previous mission. I mean, this mission is essentially a rebuild of a mission that launched in 2016, but was lost due to an orbital mishap about a month into launch. And we have, you know, after 9 months or so of calibration and performance verification, the rest of the mission lifetime, which we hope will last for many years, will be for general observers worldwide. So I mentioned this is a rebuild of a previous mission. This was the launch of a mission called Hitomi in 2016. Hitomi was lost due to an operations mishap on day 38. Prior to that, though, it had been working exceptionally well, and I'll show you exactly what I mean by exceptionally well in just a second. It had even been exceeding requirements. Even with a few weeks of operations, and we were nowhere near full operating capacity yet. We hadn't even turned all the instruments on. We were able to observe about half a dozen sources in the sky, and we have, you know, a dozen or so papers that came out of that, a few more instrument papers talking about the technology behind it. But it was really, it was quite the crushing blow when it happened, because as you'll see in a second, we got a brief glimpse into the power of what high resolution spectroscopy can be in the X-rays and how it truly is a new window on the universe that has not been explored before. This is not a small leap forward, it's a transformational leap forward. And here's what I mean by transformational. This is an optical image of the Perseus cluster. It's just a massive cluster of galaxies. In the optical, you see the individual galaxies. When you look at it in the X-rays, you basically just see a massive cloud of hot gas sort of swirling around in turbulent flow. When we pointed Hitomi at the Perseus cluster, this is what we saw. This is not a simulation. This is a real spectrum that we got in 2016. And if you're wondering how different that is from the previous spectrum of the Perseus cluster, this is just sort of a press release version of the spectrum I just showed you. This red dotted line, that was the previous best X-ray spectrum we had ever had of the Perseus cluster. So instead of seeing sharp peaks here, and all of these individual lines are real, we just had this broad hump here before. We barely had a hump right here where these other iron lines were, maybe a little bit down here where there's nickel. We had nothing here where some of these fainter elements lie. So this is what I mean when I say a transformational leap forward. To go from something that looks like the red dotted line to the white line is really a remarkable improvement. This is just showing the same thing again. This was from our actual scientific publication of this. The data is actually there in black. The model fit to the data is in red. And the blue spectrum is, again, that was the previous best spectrum we had. So you can imagine we can do a lot more physics with the black data than we can with the blue data. And we were actually able to write several papers just out of this one brief observation about the first ever time we were able to directly measure the level of turbulence within a galaxy cluster, because we can actually resolve these lines now and we can get velocity structure and things like that. As I said, we do have some imaging capabilities. We're not a high resolution imager by any means, but we can reconstruct a rudimentary image at a resolution of a 1 or 2 arc minutes or so. And when we do that, we can actually create, so this is the field of view of Hitomi. The field of view for Chrism will be identical. It is an identical instrument. It's about 3 arc minutes on a side. And what we've done here is we've color coded, because we're able to get velocity structure of the gas in a way that we were never able to do before. We can color code the blue stuff is sort of moving towards us, blue shifted. The red stuff is moving away from us. You can sort of see this entire thing is almost sloshing over the scales of hundreds of thousands of light years. This is how gas moves in a turbulent galaxy cluster. So what's the technology behind this? It's kind of cool because it's both extraordinarily simple to explain, but also very difficult to do. It's really remarkable technology. Basically, the Chrism detector is a single photon calorimeter. And a calorimeter is just anything that measures the, you know, heat change in a system when you do something to it. What we're doing here is, as individual X-ray photons come in, they are hitting this detector and they are heating it up just a tiny bit. And if we can measure that heat change from an individual photon, we can backtrack out the energy that that photon must have had when it came in. And that gives us extremely accurate measures, much better than the CCD detectors do, as I just showed. The tricky part about this, so that was what I said, that's the easy part to explain. You know, photon comes in, heats up your detector a little bit, you just measure that. The really hard part to do this is how you actually do it, because it's not a lot of heat that's generated from a single photon, even if it's an X-ray. So we have to be extraordinarily cold. We have to, our detector has to work at 50 millikelvin, which is 50 thousandths of a degree above absolute zero. The way I often like to put this when I tell people about this mission is, generally speaking, space is pretty cold. You know, space is about 3 Kelvin. For most missions, the trick is making sure your instruments are warmed up and kept warm enough to keep working in the coldness of space. We have the exact opposite problem. Space is way too hot for us. We would never be able to operate at 3 Kelvin, just the ambient temperature of outer space. So we have to have refrigeration on board to get us to a colder temperature than space. So we have a three-stage refrigeration system, a horrendously complicated device. I won't try to explain it. But basically, we go from liquid helium temperatures, and then we mechanically cool down over three stages all the way down to 0.05 Kelvin, and that is our operating temperature. This is what it looks like, the detector. For scale, this is actually one of my coworkers holding this up. So it's, you know, it's a couple of centimeters on a side here. The actual detector itself, though, is this 6x6 array of pixels. Covers about 3 arc minutes on the sky. And as you can see, that's maybe only a few millimeters on a side here. It gets put into a very complicated refrigeration system. It gets put into a Dewar like this that gets lowered into another larger Dewar outside of that. And that's where the multi-stage refrigeration process happens. This is actually kind of a cool video that our science visualization studio at Goddard made. It starts with that's a real picture of the instrument. This was actually made for Hitomi, by the way, but the details are exactly the same for us. And it's going to zoom in and go over to be a cartoon image. But this is just a cartoon simulation of the X-rays coming in one by one. And as they hit the detector, they have different energies. And so they warm it up a little more or a little less. And we can backtrack that out to a spectrum. So we also have kind of a cool thing where we don't just want to, we just want to see the X-rays. We don't want to detect charged particles, cosmic rays coming in, because those also will light our detector up. But the thing is, those charged particles, protons, alpha particles, electrons, whatever they are, as they come in, they go right through the detector. They don't get stopped. They will impart some heat to it, so they'll look like a signal, but they'll also go right through, whereas the X-rays are completely absorbed by the detector. So we just put an anti-coincidence detector right behind it. And that way, if we get a signal, but it also lights up that anti-coincidence detector behind it, we know that was not actually an X-ray photon. It was some charged particle that just came through. So we can eliminate all of those, and we actually get extraordinarily low backgrounds on this, which is really ideal. Less than one photon per day per 10 eV bin on an average observation. So virtually everything we're seeing is real signal from space. I just have some hardware pictures here. The instrument, the detector sits down in this tube. I don't know exactly how far down it is. It's somewhere down here, but the mirrors would actually be up here somewhere, you know, several meters up here. We have a focal length of about 5.5 meters. So the X-ray mirrors would be 20 feet on top of this. The X-rays come in here. All of this equipment is part of the refrigeration system that has to keep this thing cold. Here's another picture. This is some of our colleagues in Japan working on this, lowering it down into the Dewar for testing and integration. That's just what the entire thing looks like. So that's the entire Dewar system. You can see up here, this is an X-ray source that simulates X-rays coming from outer space. So we can fire them down into this and we do all sorts of testing. And this is what's going on right now. I mentioned before that the other instrument we have on board is called Extend. It's a very wide field of view, 38 arc minutes on a side. This is the field of view of Extend on an image of SN1006. which I think I mentioned earlier. If not, I'll mention it now. It's about 30 arc minutes in diameter. This is roughly the size of the full moon. So I don't think we'll point at the moon, but if we wanted to point at the moon, we could get the entire thing in one field of view. And this will have about 1.5 arc minute spatial resolution, and will work simultaneously with Resolve. So we developed the Resolve instrument at Goddard. We shipped it out to Japan in late 2019. We are also building the X-ray mirror assembly for the mission. I need to get a higher resolution version of this image because it may be a little bit hard to see, but you can actually see, you see all these lines, these arcing lines. These are individual X-ray mirror segments that are separated by, you know, much less than a millimeter in between each one. And they're just a nested set of shells that build up. We build these in quadrants. And we assemble all four quadrants together to make the full mirror. There are 203 nested segments in this. I believe they're aluminum. Don't quote me on that. I can find out. But yeah, these are manufactured at Goddard, aligned, tested, and individually laid on top of each other, basically, and spaced out at the right amount. So you can sort of do some quick math here. If we have 200 in a quadrant, and it takes four quadrants to make a circle, so that's 800 individual segments. Then you have to have your primary and your secondary, both of which have the exact same number. So that takes us up to 1,600 individual mirror segments make up a mirror. And we have two instruments. We have Resolve and Extend, each of which gets its own dedicated mirror. So that's 3,200 mirror segments that were fabricated over the past couple of years at Goddard. About 25% of them, since they all have to be individually tested, about 25% on average don't pass quality assurance. So they ended up making about 4,000 of these things. But it's really just quite an impressive operation that we have in the mirror lab up there. These are actually some pictures that I took from my phone from one of the testing facilities there. We have a long X-ray beam line at Goddard that we use to test our X-ray mirrors. So basically the mirror slides in like this, and then they close the door, and out that direction is a 100 meter long X-ray beam line that we can shoot very, very pencil beam is what we call them, X-rays through these to test them out. And of course, we're always very safe with our hardware at NASA. So we even stencil on do not drop for things that we generally don't want dropped. Lastly, I'm about to wrap up here. I have just a few more slides. I do want to point something out, though, that I mentioned earlier, that with Hitomi, when you launch a new spacecraft into space, you want to be very careful with turning things on. So we were slowly turning things on. We were nowhere near at full operational capacity. We had not even removed yet a valve that sits in front of the detector that actually blocks most of your X-rays. So when I showed this picture earlier from Hitomi, I didn't point this out, but really anything below, it's not that the actual spectrum drops off down here. It's just that everything below about 3 keV is completely blocked by this valve that had not even been opened yet. When we get to full operational capacity with CRISM, the spectrum will look something more like this. And for reference, I've included the blue spectrum. That's the previous spectrum here before. The black is obviously a simulation since we haven't launched yet. But we think we'll go from something that looked like the blue spectrum to something that looks like the black spectrum. So again, really revolutionary stuff here. I've just done a few simulation slides to show sort of the science that we expect to do with CRISM. This is Tycho Supernova. I did this simulation. This is what we think it will look like. And you might notice, you might say, wait a minute, that spectrum looks a little bit different than the one you showed before. Because the one you showed before had these really sharp, sharp peaks from all these spectral lines. And these look kind of broader, don't they? You're right, but that's real. That's real physics there. Remember, Tycho Supernova remnant is expanding at like 5,000 kilometers per second still. That gas that's being heated up there in the X-rays, that's 30 million degree gas. There's just a massive amount of even Doppler broadening of these lines. But we will be able to directly measure that for the first time. We will actually resolve the velocity structure of these lines. And in fact, if we put this down the middle of the remnant, which we are definitely going to do and get a spectrum right down the barrel of this thing, we actually expect that all of these spectral lines will separate out into blue and red shifted components, just from the stuff that's going that way and the stuff that's coming toward us. So it'll basically look like we have two spectra plotted on top of each other. And that, it's easy to describe, but it's never something we've been able to see before until we have this this sort of mission. I'm sure you all recognize M51. This is actually a Chandra X-ray image of M51. Galaxies will be a very important topic for PRISM. We'll make the first precise measurements of things like temperature and abundances of various elements in the hot interstellar medium of the galaxies. And what do I mean by precise? Well, again, that's an actual Chandra spectrum of M51. You sort of have to be an X-ray astronomer to appreciate this spectrum, but that little hump right there is oxygen. This stuff is all iron in here. There's a little hump right here from magnesium. So it's all there, but you really gotta know what you're doing to see that. The spectrum we'll get from CRISM will look like that. And I've left the blue spectrum there before. So we're really operating on the exact opposite end of parameter space from Chandra. Chandra makes spectacular high resolution images, not so great spectroscopy. We will make spectacular high resolution spectroscopy and not so great images, but hopefully we put all these things together and a more coherent scientific picture pops out. This is another famous galaxy, NGC 1365. An X-ray image at the center shows an extraordinarily bright active galactic nucleus. This is just a supermassive black hole that is accreting matter from around it. Active galactic nuclei, or AGN as we call them, are extremely bright sources in the X-rays because as matter is about to pass the point of no return into a black hole, it gets heated up quite a lot to millions of degrees. So these things just glow in the X-rays. Again, this is a previous spectrum. This is a spectrum from X&M Newton, which is a European X-ray telescope that's operational right now. And this is what we will anticipate seeing. And so we're seeing not just a lot more lines in the spectrum, but we also might see things like these little peaks right here that you don't really see in this spectrum. These peaks are what we expect. It's something we expect to see. We just haven't been able to see it yet with the current suite of instruments. But we think that it's a scattered emission off of the outflow from other gas. And this will give us, if that is correct, that will be a completely new measure for the dynamics of how AGN operate. How do they accrete material, but also blow a wind at the same time? So this will really be revolutionary. My last slide is just the obligatory, how has COVID-19 impacted us? The Resolve instrument was shipped out a few months before the pandemic hit. It actually left Goddard on Veterans Day in November of 2019. We had people there with it in Japan the entire time until they had to come home in late February when COVID hit. For several months, we were completely operating remotely. You know, we were nightly Zoom calls with our colleagues in Japan. Actually, in July of 2020, we were approved to start sending small teams back to Japan to work with our colleagues there and work on integration and testing of the instrument. I have not been one of these people. I'm not an instrument person, so I have not needed to go. I love travel, but I didn't want to go on one of these trips because the travel is just extremely onerous. They have to do a two-week quarantine when they arrive in Japan. It's basically solitary confinement in a hotel room where they bring you meals three times a day, but you can't leave the room. They do that for 2 weeks before being allowed to go work on the instrument. Aside from that, we're making the best of a bad situation. Communication works reasonably well. As I said, there are people, you know, we have people constantly pulling all-nighters. They kind of work in shifts because Japan is obviously on the other side of the world. So their daytime is our nighttime. And I would just say I've been extraordinarily happy with the dedication of team members on both sides of the Pacific to really really work through this this pandemic. Work on the mirrors has resumed in person at Goddard. The CRISM science team, which is about 100 or 120 astronomers from around the world, we typically meet every 6 months. We have a lot of activity going at all times. Every 6 months or so, we get together in person. We have always traditionally done those in Japan because that's where the majority of the team resides. Of course, we have not been able to do that for the past 2 years, so we are still holding our meetings virtually. But as I said, we're doing the best we can. we hope to be launching in early 2023. And so that's my last slide. If you want to learn more about this mission, you can go to either the JAXA website, which I've highlighted does have an English version. You can also go to the NASA website. And I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Okay, so at this time, if you want to raise your hand and we can call on you so that we're not all trying to talk at once, or if we just have enough shy people and slow to react, any questions?
This was a fantastic talk.
Thank you. Am I supposed to call on people, or is I see John?
No, I'm kind of waiting for anyone to raise their hand or to start speaking, or
it looks like John has his hand raised actually and physically in person.
Okay, go ahead, John.
Hand raised. You have to unmute, John. John,
I have two questions. Is the refrigerator that you use a dilution refrigerator?
It is called an adiabatic dimagnetization refrigerator.
I see. Okay.
I'm not familiar with the dilution refrigerator, but I don't think so, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, the ones they use in quantum computing with superconductors, they use temperatures down there too, and they use dilution refrigerators. The other question is, are supernova much less frequent in elliptical galaxies?
That's a good question. I mean, in general, yes, the rate in spiral galaxies is generally higher than in ellipticals because there's a lot more active star formation going on in spiral galaxies. And I didn't really get into the types of supernovae, but the more common type is called core collapse supernovae, and that's the end of the life of a very massive star, you know, 10 solar masses or more. To get those types of stars, you need very recent star formation because they don't last very long. They last, obviously this is astronomically speaking, but you know, a star that massive might only last a few tens of millions of years or so. So, but you're right, yes. And elliptical galaxies, ellipticals are usually called red and dead galaxies because there's basically no active formation going on. You can get the other type though, type 1A supernova, which is the explosion of a white dwarf, billions of years old. So those are pretty much all we see in ellipticals though.
Thank you.
Right, David Dunham has a question. You know,
the Milky Way is a spiral galaxy, of course, but we are a relatively low star formation galaxy. We're not particularly active, which may be one of the reasons we just haven't seen a particularly high rate of supernovae. But it's also, it's probably more just luck. We might just be in a period now. Maybe the next 100 years we'll have 10 of them go off. Who knows?
Okay, I think David Dunham has a question. Go ahead, David.
Okay, I was just wondering exactly what was the operational error that caused Hitomi to fail?
I knew somebody would ask that. I'll try to give you the short version. You know, the long version is, I give an entire talk on that. I mean, there's a 700 page document or something that JAXA produced. It was actually several things. Essentially what happened was the telescope, there was some telemetry that was uploaded to it that didn't quite make sense to the onboard control system. And that happens all the time. And we usually have redundant systems to catch that sort of thing. One of the things that the telescope is supposed to do is If all else fails, go find the sun, and the telescope will do that automatically. It had a sun sensor on board. The sun sensor, for some reason, was unable to locate the sun. So basically the telescope, you know, people sometimes think that we are in constant contact with telescopes and we're constantly telling them what to do. And that's not true. Most of their operation is autonomous. I mean, we're only, you know, when they pass over one of our ground states, then we can contact with it. But for the most part, we have to upload commands to telescopes to let them, you know, run themselves because we're not in constant contact with them. And no telescope works that way, by the way. Nobody's ever in constant contact. So basically, the onboard systems basically got confused. some of the software was not properly written and really was not properly checked. And there was a lot of heads rolled, let's just put it that way, at the spacecraft contractor who wrote that. Eventually what happened is that spacecraft realized that it was starting to spin and it wasn't spinning the right direction. So to counteract the spin, the onboard thrusters started firing. Well, thrusters are pretty powerful things, and there was a sign error in the code, positive instead of negative or negative instead of positive, that again should have been caught during the spacecraft testing. The spacecraft operations company was NEC, who I always remember NEC because when I was growing up, the first computer we had was an NEC, but NEC is a Japanese company who was the prime contractor for the spacecraft. And to be blunt, they just didn't do a very good job of checking their software and testing it beforehand. So they had a sign error in the thrusters, and instead of slowing this now spinning telescope around, they just spun it up even faster, and eventually it just flew apart. A lot of angular momentum on a pretty large spacecraft, and it doesn't take much for it to just rapidly disassemble itself.
I've noticed that most of the NASA space telescopes, after the telescope is launched and start working, they'll start needing it for a person. Is that likely to happen with this one? I just looked up Hitomi, and that just means eyeball or apple.
That's right. Yeah, Japan does not typically name their missions after people. They typically name them after all sorts of things. Like you said, Hitomi just means eye on the universe. There was a previous mission called Asuka, which is some sort of bird in Japan. I actually don't know the answer to your question, I would not be surprised if at the same time you do. They tend to keep that very close. That's a Japanese tradition that really falls down to the PI of the mission to be able to rename them. And so if he tells me ahead of time, great, but I may find out the time the rest of the world does when he says, I will say they typically do not rename them until a successful launch, but I do not know if that will happen here or not.
Okay, Jim Simpson has a question. Go ahead, Jim. Unmute yourself.
Yep. Actually, I've got two questions. One I've already answered, I just missed it. What's the expected life of PRISM? I assume the helium is finite resource.
Do you want me to answer that? I'll answer that one first, yeah, and then I'll get your second one. Good question. The helium is a finite resource. The mission requirement is to have at least 3 years of helium, but we actually think we can get a little bit more. The early projections for Hitomi were about 4 years of helium. But, and here's the cool part, running out of the helium is actually not the end of the lifetime of the mission. And we can actually fully operate in cryogen-free mode because we have this magnetization, this ADR refrigerator on board that can mechanically cool down. So you might ask, why do you need helium at all? The reason is that helium gives us a much bigger head start to getting cold. And so we can cool down with the helium. If the helium starts us at 4 Kelvin, we can get down to 50 millikelvin in a matter of minutes. Without that, if we have to go purely on mechanical cooling, it'll take us a couple of hours each duty cycle to cool down. But all we lose is operational efficiency. We go from being about 98% efficient in terms of efficiency being, we can point at something right now and we would get a spectrum. We'll go from about 98% efficient to something like 80, 85% efficient. So it's really not a big loss, but we at least start with the helium and get as much of that as we can. And you said you got a second question, I think.
So just on that first one. So it sounds like you figure we're probably gonna run out of helium in about 4 years. So is there a finite life to the mechanical cooling on that?
I'm sure there will be something that will eventually stop working, but we actually have no resources that run out. So I certainly hope we are operating into the 2030s. There's no fundamental physical reason we can't. Eventually something will break. Something always breaks, and we're not in a serviceable orbit. I would love for this mission to run for a decade or more.
Okay. Well, my second question is if you could be granted a wish, where would you, how close or how far would you like the next supernova to be?
Oh, good question. Not too close, because, too close is not a good thing. I think that, people have somewhat done these calculations of where would we start to be in the danger zone? And I think I think certainly within a few hundred light years would really be problematic. The good news is we actually don't think there are any candidates too close to us. if I had my choice, I would love for Betelgeuse to explode. I think Betelgeuse is far enough away that we would be okay. I think it would be an absolutely spectacular light show. I mean, the calculations for if Betelgeuse were to explode, I think the peak magnitude would rival the full moon in brightness and would probably, at that distance, stay visible for years. So that's my preference. We do think Betelgeuse is on the verge of exploding, but of course, again, on the verge means from an astronomical time scale. That means it could explode tomorrow or it could explode 100,000 years from now. We have no way of knowing.
Sue, go ahead. You've got a question.
I'm sitting here just stunned by your story of what happened with the Hitomi mission. Yeah. Did that go through the IV&V facility, or did NEC do their own quality control?
I'm not sure. NEC, yeah. So it, by IV&V, you mean the NASA IV&V facility?
Yeah, the one in West Virginia there.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think they had anything to do with this because we actually had nothing. All we did for Hitomi was we provided the resolve instrument. At the time, we called it the SXS. We provided that instrument and we provided the mirrors, and we had no input whatsoever into spacecraft operations. When that mission was lost, the president of JAXA himself flew to Washington, D.C., met with NASA headquarters folks, said that doing a recovery mission to, they called it recovery, which always confuses people. It's not, we're not going out to recover it, but it's to recover the science. He said that was a top priority for JAXA's astrophysics program, and he wanted NASA to be involved again. And there was so much, because as you've seen, it's just such spectacular science you can get out of this, that there was a lot of support within the U.S. astronomical community as well, and NASA agreed. We did request to be given a little more input into the operations and a little more quality checking on that. It's still their mission. We're not taking it over, but I will say that we are somewhat more involved this time than we were last time in the mission operation stuff, which doesn't mean it will, you know, we're not perfect either, but, you know, hopefully with at least another agency set of eyes on things, we won't do the same thing, though.
I'd like to make just a brief comment about those failure modes. A group I was in at another lab had passenger instruments on two of the French Spot spacecraft, and both eventually failed, and they basically mimicked the failure mechanisms that you described. There were operational blunders.
Yeah, ultimately, a lot of it comes down to human error. And so just making sure that there are enough safety checks and redundancy checks in place is always the way to go about it. I mean, if a meteor hits us, there's nothing we can do about that. But the human element is always the hardest one to control.
Manjunath, go ahead. Manjunath, we can't hear you. You're unmuted, but we can't hear you. Yeah, there's no sound coming from you. You want to type your question into the chat and I can read it out?
Mic test.
Yep, you're working, Jeff.
I see his question now in the chat.
No.
I'm going to answer that. Are there any ground-based X-ray telescopes? No, there are not. And there's a good reason for that, because we have an atmosphere. That's a good thing to have an atmosphere. It absorbs all X-rays, though. You could not get anything through the atmosphere. So, no, you got to go to space if you want to do X-rays.
Okay, Jeff Gerber, you have a question?
Yes. My mic was apparently not working earlier there. So I typed this into the chat, actually.
One of the early supernova remnants that you talked about, I think you said it is still too hot to be seen in visible or infrared and can only be seen in X-rays, except for a very small part. But my question is, other more recent and SNRs, like the Crab, for instance, are very spectacular. They are spectacularly seen in the visible and the IR. So why is that first one not yet cooling enough, or conversely, why is, for example, the Crab sufficiently cool that we can see it even though it's younger?
Yeah, well, the short answer is the Crab is a weird object. The crab is not really a supernova remnant in the traditional sense of the word. What I showed there, I mentioned this, but it might have gone too quickly there. What we know as the Crab Nebula is what we really call a pulsar wind nebula. And that's, you have a rapidly spinning neutron star that is just depositing massive amounts of energy into the surrounding material. And the surrounding material is mostly ejected from the star. So I guess the simple way I would describe it is, really what you're seeing in the Crab Nebula is the material that's sort of being lit up by the pulsar. It's not actually really the supernova remnant. And it's even weirder than that, because you remember how I was sort of giving the cartoon description of remnants, and they have this usually circular structure, which is the outer blast wave. No one has ever found the blast wave in the Crab Nebula. We have no idea where it is. We've looked in radio, we've looked in X-rays, we've looked in optical. It is just not there. When we look out, we just don't see a circular structure. So it has to be there. I mean, there has to be a blast wave, but the current thinking is that the Crab must have gone off into a region of just extraordinarily low density. And there's basically just nothing there for the shockwave to run into. You only see the shockwave when it's running into something and lighting it up. And if there's nothing there, then we think that's what's happening with the Crab.
Wow. So what we are seeing in, from the Crab is material that the star ejected before it went supernova?
No, after the ejected material of the supernova. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? Are some of those animations available on the web of the supernova shells expanding?
Yep, all of them are. So let's see. Let me go back to my. So I showed two movies from Tycho. I had the one from the X-ray and the one from radio.
Yep.
Those were actually both produced by the Chandra X-ray Observatory's PR folks. So if you go to their website, or if you Google maybe Tycho's supernova Chandra or something like that, you can probably pretty easily find a link to their website where they have various animations like that. What were the other ones that I showed? The brief little animation of CRISM, where it was started with the detector and then kind of zoomed in and went to a cartoon version of the X-rays coming in. That's online as well. How would you find that really? Probably just, oh good, someone put some link in the chat.
Yeah, that's
what that is. So that's actually, yeah, that's an earlier one. That's actually not the movie that I showed, but I think if you go to maybe 2017 or so, or there might be a search function. I think there's a search function up at the top right there. The ones from Hitomi, that visualization I showed, it was made by the SVS, the Science Visualization Studio at Goddard. So if you Google, SVS, Goddard Space Flight Center or something, you can find their website. And I think they also have a search function. I think if you put in Hitomi or X-ray or something like that, you can probably find those. But yeah, everything I showed here, as far as I know, should be online.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah. Is ESR involved with PRISM? Will there be a U.S. data center?
There is, yep. So ESR just stands for High Energy Astrophysics Archive. So yeah, they will be the main archive for all the data that comes down. And yes, we do have a U.S., we call them the SDC Science Data Center. They're the people who are responsible for doing everything from writing the data reduction software. So when we get the x-rays down from the telescope, the actual pipeline for data reduction is being written that falls under the NASA purview when our description of duties were put out. So yeah, we are writing the pipeline software for that. and that'll be translated to the HESARC. And some things like, you know, proposal submission and review will be done simultaneously by both the US and Japan. But yeah, we have a very active science data center.
Okay, any other questions? Let's see. All right, then maybe a nice round of applause.
Well, thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun. I hope maybe if you want to have me back in a few years after we start getting real results, I'd be happy to come back. And then maybe we can do it in person and I can show you. Instead of a bunch of simulations, I'll actually just start showing results.
That would be okay. Awesome.
I'll remember that.
Okay. We'll look forward to that.
Yep. All right. I'm going to sign off now. So thanks again, everyone.
All right. Thank you very much, Brian. You have a good evening.
You too. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. And thank you to everyone for coming out this month. We'll see you next month, January 8th. And so y'all have a good week. Happy holidays. And anything else? Do you have anything else, Harold?
No. Thank you, Elizabeth.
All right. Then y'all have a good evening. Take care.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Bye.